So in the past 20 years, according to Judith Buttonen, there's been a surge in the popularity of biopics on Shakespeare, Austen, Wolfe, among many others. And Buttonen states that there are similarities in production and marketing, patterns of characterization and themes. And according to her, the figures staged were mostly male writers. I think this might have changed over the last few years. So I'm wondering what appeal do literary figures and literary process hold as subject? And one can wonder about the elements which have been cinematically iconized and even iconically conventionalized in such biopics. And so I'm going to turn to a different medium, which is YouTube mini web series entitled Edgar Allan Poe's Murder Mystery Dinner Party. This series is made of 11 episodes, each between 10 and 20 minutes long. It was created by Shipwrecked, which stands for Sean and Sinead Purcell, who are two American comedians who were interested in creating comedic historical literary content. And the series was directed by William J. Strebling. So in 2016, they came up with the series using conventions of costume and heritage drama. And the series is oriented towards, let's say, people interested in literature. So the pitch is that Poe, assisted with Lena, which is originally the name of a poem by Poe, dealing with the death of a woman who is in the show a ghost, and Poe, who is in love with Annabel Lee being the name of Poe's last poem, also dealing with the death of the poet's beloved. So Poe invites his friends to a murder mystery dinner party. And so here's the list of guests. And I'd like to focus first maybe on what the potential aims of the show might be before turning to what might be possibly problematic about it. So the show partakes of a trend consisting in revivifying great past authors, going against Barthes' idea that the author is dead. This is a quote by Cora Kaplan, who was already mentioned this morning, and she states the healthy demand for Victorian literary biography and biofiction suggests either that the death of the author has been greatly exaggerated, or that the threat has breathed new life into the idea of the author. And on the contrary, the emergence of neo-Victorian biofiction might echo a real desire for the author figure. So I'm not going to discuss too much, the veracity of the facts being presented, as this has already been at the core of our discussions today, the fact that these are representations of the authors. They are not the authors themselves, but creations inspired from them. So what we have here is a comedic work of fiction based on real-life authors. I guess the idea behind the show is to make these authors accessible to a millennial public, familiar with irony by recalling well-known biographic information about them, such as Poe's neuroticism or Dickinson's reclusiveness. So I'm going to show you one extract, which is about the arrival. If we can make this work, yes. The arrival of the authors.
Welcome, friend, to Edgar Allan Poe's Murder Mystery Invite-Only Casual Dinner Party / Gala for Friends Potluck. Lenore will take your dish and your coat.
Looks like you got yourself a ghost infestation, friend. Looky here, I brought a switchblade so we can skewer wild boar in the backyard. And then we can roast it over an open flame. Only an open flame.
Louisa May Alcott. Happy to see the stink of Boston hasn't followed you. Now, what dish did you bring?
You'll find you can eat anything if you're hungry enough.
Mary Shelley, as I live and breathe.
Yes, I get it. I brought this loaf of bread. I forgot the yeast, so it hasn't risen. Because of
Yes, of course. I get it. I got it. The first time. Ah, Charlotte Bronte. Here is your character card for the union.
Oh, she sounds poor. Did you write this? Is this going to take very long?
Oscar, so glad you could come. You're looking very smart.
You can never be overdressed or overeducated.
Hello, H.G. Wells. H, for short, H.G., what do we go by?
I cooked it myself with my latest contraption. It's an enclosure that bombards the food with electromagnetic radiation such that the food molecules themselves actually...
Fine, wonderful. Just come in.
It's incredibly efficient.
It's not a real thing. Oh, thought someone knocked.
Oh, I did. I knocked.
I'm sorry, who are you?
Emily Dickinson. I stay in my room a lot. I write poems like you, though. We're actually a lot alike.
I don't think so, but we may have an extra spot.
You invited me.
You know, you could be really pretty if you just did your hair differently, maybe wore a different outfit, and just kind of tried something else up here.
Ah. Marianne, so...
Name's Elliot. George Elliot. Likes. Beer. Sporting. Talking about sporting. Dislikes. Peeing sitting down, tending to the home, not talking about sporting.
Marianne, I'm not sure I understand.
It seems you have me confused with some sort of damsel. I understand. I have very soft skin. But the name's George Elliot. It's two male names. It's easy to remember. Now, show me to the billiard room. Or a voting booth.
I'll stop there. Otherwise, I'll never be able to... read my paper, but at least you've got a little, you know, teasing effect here. So you can see that some characters are easily recognizable, so Poe and Lena. Ernest Hemingway being presented as, you know, smoking, alpha male type, let's say, with references to his father working with cutlery, wildlife. George Eliot, as you could see, pretends that she's a man, and this is a recurring joke. So she performs hyper-masculinity while Poe calls her Marianne, and everybody knows anyway that she's a woman, so that's the running joke of the series. H.G. Wells as this sort of nerd inventor who comes up with all these very clever ideas. And yes, Emily Dickinson. Oscar Wilde, Mary Shelley, and yes, that's it. So, the other characters are easily recognizable, and the series really plays with the audience knowledge about these authors. George Eliot pretending to be a man is an extrapolation of her taking a male pen name, or Oscar Wilde being extremely effeminate here is a way to suggest, not without problems, I guess, that he is gay. But what echoes the subtitle are also the tongue-in-cheek hints. Indeed, the game is going to turn into a new performance of Agatha Christie's And Then There Were None, except that each writer who dies at the end of each episode does so in a manner that is... that befits their writing. So, for instance, Mary Shelley is going to die electrocuted as a direct reference to Frankenstein. Agatha Christie is stabbed even before making it to the threshold, etc. And as the setting is a Victorian mansion, the background is the Victorian era, there will be a psychic summoned for a seance in order to resurrect the dead authors. So there's a special bond between the author, the audience, and the creators of the show, which is created through the many famous quotes that are used in a different context, yet which are in the public domain and easily recognizable. So, it's a game of spot the reference, which is played with the audience. So just a quick one here. It is the truth universally acknowledged that snitches get stitches. Or you guys really should have had a bit more sense and or sensibility. So
Or there are references to the writing style of some authors. So, for instance, Hemingway at some point says, "I don't hide between witticisms and Burmo. I tell it like it is." And there are several references to, let's say, his art of brevity. Most of the episodes' names are also taken from Poe's literary works, which also creates a feeling of shared knowledge or complicity between the viewers and the authors of the series. So there is a sense of the pleasure of the text, I would say, with the audience playing these guests of, you know, spotting the references. And one other aim of the series might be to challenge, you know, the myth-like status of these writers. And plus, in a typically neo-Victorian vein, it manages to resurrect writers of the past only to have them progressively killed on screen, thus indulging in the pleasure of literalizing Barthes' phrase about the death of the author. Another interesting level, I think, to be noted in the series is the reappropriation of 19th century material and serial culture in a 21st century artifact. Several Victorian authors make it to the list of Poe's guests, such as George Eliot, and Victorian England being often described as the age of seriality, with the practice of publishing installments in magazines, is echoed here through the fact that each episode of the series in 2016 was uploaded to YouTube once a week, so you actually had to wait for the following week in order to get, you know, what was coming next, the following episode. And the fact of having this mini-series with each episode ending on a cliffhanger is certainly reminiscent of Victorian seriality. And I think materialism is also present through references to creative anguish or references to economic stress with Bronte and Hemingway's money issues. Adding to this, there are many goodies the audience are provided with in the form of bloopers, prologue and videos staging Mark Twain or Emerson, but also t-shirts and caps. So in a very clever and I would say profitable understanding of Victorian material culture. And I would add that for the series to be made, the creators launched a Kickstarter campaign to raise money through crowdfunding. So here again, linking the series to a very materialistic mode of production. And what makes this show neo-Victorian, to my mind, is its self-conscious component, what we discussed earlier today, because the show mocks the writers by challenging their mythical status and transforming them into, let's say, likable or maybe relatable characters. And it also makes fun of frequent misconceptions about literature, which, for instance, has Wilde once asked George Eliot, "So Frankenstein is not the name of the creature, then?" Or finally, we academics are also gently ridiculed because, for instance, once the police starts investigating into the disappearance of Agatha Christie, Poe accounts for the presence of so many writers at its place by explaining that they are holding a conference on food metaphors, which I guess is something, you know, we could understand. So the show, you know, it's really pleasant to watch. It flatters the audience's literary vein. It's both funny and, yes, let's say smart. So what are the issues that one can have with it? Maybe issues is not exactly the right term, but at least I'll use this term. Let's say that the series produces a postmodern mashup of temporalities and locations, among others, which can be called neo-Victorian. So if you paid attention to the list of guests, you can see that simply looking at the dates of birth and death of the authors presented here is enough to see that some have lived in completely different times and places. They simply have not met in real life. And the series also mashes up the long 19th century with Regency, the Victorians, the Edwardians, the Modernists, while it uniformizes writing contexts, which makes it possible for all these different writers to meet. And I guess, you know, this might not be considered as a problem if you consider that artistic license is what prevails. But I think this blurring of categories also puts on the same level writers who may have been popular in their time may no longer be now, or who used to be more notorious than others. And I guess it increases the effect of homogeneity that that was also mentioned earlier this morning, the fact that it sort of erases parallelations and hierarchy in culture and literature, which still exist and sometimes can be discriminating. But here again, I guess it depends on the viewpoint you are choosing, because this breaking of hierarchy could also be seen as something positive. How long do I have?
8 minutes.
Okay, I think that should be okay. A good counterpoint could be that there's no reverence towards male figures, or nor too much insistence on the depressive nature of female writers, which is something that has been sometimes presented in biopics. And this is what Dennis Bingham shows. I don't know if I can find this. No, okay. No worries. Because he says that draws a clear distinction between male and female biopics, tending to abide by these rules, actually, the reverence towards male figures, as opposed to women writers sometimes being presented as depressive, hysterical, etc. So this is not exactly what happens here, and I guess it's also a neo-Victorian gesture not to look into great Victorian male figures like Dickens or Thackeray, Hardy, but focus on alternative classical or female writers and less central figures as well. What this series also favors is the sketching up of a limited number of features, and of course the series cannot portray these authors in a complex way. And given the format of the miniseries and some writing choices, the writers can only be made into types. Let's have a look at Dostoevsky. The first thing he says is that he brought vodka, for instance. So I guess, like in biofiction, you know, it's necessary to choose to focus on certain aspects, granting them eternity while obliviating others. And Hemingway being presented as drunkard, as a drunkard and womanizer. This is also a running joke throughout the series. And as Benton recalls about literary fiction, the narrative of biography imposes a shape on real-life histories involving selection, continuity, coherence, and closure. And he adds, quote, "Each age rewrites the biographies of its favored authors in ways which reflect the mores and literary conventions of the period," end quote. And I guess Poe being conveniently figured as socially awkward is interesting because this is a type which has become popular in recent cultural productions. If you think of the geeks in The Social Network, the movie, or the BBC series, you know, Sherlock, The Big Bang Theory, or The Nerds of Silicon Valley, well, this is a type that has been recognizable and presented in such cultural productions over the last few years. So in that respect, the show questions, and here I'm quoting Kaplan, the image of the Victorian age as a period of confident humanism and individual self-respect, end quote, by staging these characters as isolated or neurotic. And here again, it's interesting to focus about what is remembered about these authors and what facts and which authors are also completely forgotten. And I found it fascinating that Charlotte Bronte should become a very posh, scornful character in the series, because from what we know about the author, be it in Gaskell's presentation, in her biography of Charlotte Bronte, or in more recent research about the character, while the, let's say, highly sophisticated, posh attitude is not something that you would find. But here again, I suppose, you know, it has to do with creative license, and it goes back to what we were saying earlier this morning about what the readers might be expecting, given the knowledge they have or not about this or that author. And I think more interestingly, the fact that some authors are presented as the happy few suggests that the show needed to forget other writers. And I said that Dickens didn't appear as a proper character, even though he's mentioned very briefly in the series. And I was thinking of Kipling as well, who is also very briefly mentioned but does not appear as a character. And I think it echoes what was already discussed this morning about the fact that there might be a certain neo-Victorian reluctance at dealing with villains, and you know, Kipling being the harsh imperialist maybe couldn't make it to the series. Oh yeah, that's the quote I was looking for earlier. So these videos, which happen to have hundreds of thousands of views, are maybe not as innocent as you know they could seem, and they may contribute at their level to reshaping a certain literary canon by reappraising authors who are already considered the greatest British or world authors, but also by influencing how the latter might be remembered, but also by picking more, let's say, marginal authors, and also by leaving others outside, off-screen, let's say. So if literary biofiction, according to Lena Stavecker, seeks, and I'm quoting her, to undermine and to complement cliched perceptions, end quote, the show here plays with cliches that often already exist about the writers, merely expanding them rather than really challenging them, unless they have already been challenged elsewhere. And I might speak about this later. But to me, even if there are definitely elements that link it to neo-Victorianism, I also think it might be more a comment on neo-Victorian comments on the Victorians than directly looking at the Victorians. And I think that might be my final point. The series, sometimes without subtlety and sometimes problematically, stages gender, I think, with Elliot trying to convince the other authors that she's a man by wearing a fake mustache and speaking in a deep voice, or Shelley, who is wearing black lace and he's thus associated with the goth girl figure, whose speech is full of hyperbole and melodramatic components or elements, tends to be presented as depressive and overreactive, which is one stereotype about women that has existed for ages, and so that is here reproduced and repeated. And I guess about Wilde, even if it creates this humorous effect, you know, the equation effeminate equals gay is still upsetting, and it feeds into cliches, which still get gay people being discriminated against. So I guess it's interesting to ask again the question of ethics. You know, what does the series produce? What do you expect from such a series? Does it have to be ethical? Does it have to represent all types of authors, genders, etc.? So in conclusion, I would say that the show can be seen as neo-Victorian in the way that it engages with a certain act of revisioning the Victorians, even though maybe indirectly. And it certainly engages with female authors, recentering them, breaking already existing hierarchies in literature and culture. For instance, with having H.G. Wells standing alongside Bronte or Eliot. But its mashup aesthetics also blurs lines and categories, possibly leading to false interpretations, misconceptions, such as the one about Charlotte Bronte. So this show is appealing to a millennial public. It's very much playing on irony, but I think that, and this will be my final words, just as biofiction, it should not be taken for what it is not. So it never, you know, pretended to be a scholarly research on the Victorians. And I guess this also has to do with the fact that it partakes of edutainment. So basically, both instructing, but still being linked to this commercial aspect. So there is an upsetting of the status of the mythic writer, but still a comforting of the Western audience in, let's say, a reverential, gently irreverential attitude to the author figures. So I would say that it's in line with what Christian Gutleben calls soft po, you know, soft postmodernism. And to paraphrase the subtitle to the series, it is superficially feminist, visibly liberal, humorously pleasant, but maybe not too deeply challenging. And yet, does it have to? So that's it.